Thank you for joining us for the Dev Team. We're your hosts, Mark Onsman,
Jake Overall,
and Ryan Coates.
We're a group of developers and instructors here to discuss the world of software development. So whether you're brand new or an experienced developer, we're here to chat on topics that affect our lives each and every day. This week on the Dev Team, I start off talking about incremental versus iterative development. Jake flies back in from vacation with GitHub Copilot. And finally, Ryan deep dives into the world of AI and machine learning. All right. Well, let me kind of jump in by first welcoming Jake back from his vacation.
Oh, thank you very much. I appreciate it.
So today I kind of actually was going to kick us off a little bit with word of the day. It's actually two words of the day, but they do relate a little bit. And that is incremental versus iterative development. So this is kind of something, it's a little Scrum based, so that's why I jumped on it, but it also kind of talks about how we approach problems and build projects and things like that. And especially when I talk to juniors frequently, it's kind of this idea of, hey, I want to build an app and I don't know what to do and blah, 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 blah. And I think that there's several steps ahead of this, but eventually when it comes to once you kind of made your plan and all that, I would encourage people, especially if you're looking at a team of developers, one over the other, or maybe a combination of both. So let me first try kind of put some definitions out there for you. So when we think about software development, there's kind of that Scrum process where we do things. There's also the good old-fashioned waterfall design of things. And the first one of incremental development, this is kind of the idea of incremental is this idea of we are constantly, this is more what you think of with a standard waterfall approach, that we are, hey, team, we're going to build the search functionality of our app first, and we're not going to move on to any other part of the application until we get this one feature done. And that's kind of, and we continue to work, and once that's perfect and all the code's good, then we move on to the next part of the app, and then we move on to the next part of the app, and eventually we built all the pieces and the app is done. The other way you see this is kind of the way good old Internet Explorer would load an image. It paints it essentially one row at a time of portions of the image. And then kind of the other approach to this of an iterative design is essentially we're going to kind of work on all pieces of the app or maybe multiple portions of the app at once. And every time, every iteration, we continue to improve and expand and grow within that feature set. So this would be kind of how we load maybe a modern image on the web, where we kind of load kind of the blurry, rough image. And then on the second iteration or second pass, we get it maybe a little cleaner, a little sharper. And on the third, final pass, we get that real sharp, crisp, clean app. Kind of that approach of you get a barely functional, but functional app, and then you continue to grow and expand the features as you go.
To ask a clarifying question then around this, to throw this out there, in the world of development, and I think this is true in pretty much any industry, and correct me if I'm wrong, but in Scrum, we have increments, and we also have the iterative approach, definitely coming, or iteration is a very common developer term. And so you're talking these two terms specific to project management, team organization, maybe even personnel organization, right? And so when I think of an increment, right, I think of a deliverable. We have a deliverable every single week, or whatever our sprint just so happens to be, if it's every 2 weeks or something of that nature. Like, we have an increment that we are trying to hit, which is, hey, we're putting this feature set together. Ideally, when we deliver this feature set, it is complete, but it may not be the final product. Is that kind of what you're getting at, the difference between those two
things? Yeah, you're kind of jumping a little bit to the end, but that's okay. And that's more or less the combination of the two. And that's to kind of say, hey, we need to identify a few features, and we're going to kind of build out their initial functionality. So again, if you think about, oh, we're building an app that does, blah, 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 X, Y, Z. If you thought in the first sprint, we're going to be able to, you can log into your account, and that's, we get the login working and you can edit your profile, right? But it turns out the app is like a photo uploading app, or maybe you're building, like an Instagram type thing. And so that the one philosophy is we're going to get login working perfectly. You can change your password. You can reset your password. You can do that, forgot password, all that kind of stuff. We get 100% of that working. And maybe we also, after that, because it's kind of a part of your account, you can edit your picture and username and profile and all that kind of stuff. And while that's great and all, and you've basically built out all the features necessary for account, if you were now showing this to the client, they might go, cool, we want a photo app, not an app that you can log in and edit your profile. So the idea of kind of the combination of both is, hey, we're going to get one team to kind of get started on that login. And maybe in that first amount of time, because we've kind of reduced resources, they're only getting kind of the basic login and maybe some basic profile edits. But at the same time, another team has gotten photo uploading working. And so you present more of a completed app.
So to throw another word in there, then I think what we're trying to avoid, and I think this takes a somewhat more mature team, is bottlenecks, right? We have bottlenecks in development, and there are certain things that as I'm developing an application, I legitimately, no one can move forward until XYZ feature is done, right? But those are, and should be, very few and far between, right? But I think it takes a somewhat more mature team to say, okay, well, hey, for this increment or for this particular sprint, we are going to work on, you know, the login. And so maybe I have a team dedicated to my auth login, and eventually they'll get around to forgot password, reset password, you know, email verification, you know, two-step and all that other junk that goes into it, right? But in the meantime, I shouldn't have my, you know, image processing team being locked behind. They can't move forward, right? But, and again, knowing where to draw those clear lines and divide out those feature sets, like that's one of the roles and responsibilities of, you know, the development team when you're sitting in your, correct me if I'm wrong, but your sprint planning meeting, when I'm pulling those items out of the backlog, I should be able to, as a team, maturely talk about, well, yeah, this is not a feature blocking versus this is feature blocking. Are we getting at the right concept here?
Yeah, definitely. That's certainly where you want to be, because that's where you run into is 100% like, oh, well, I can't do image uploading until I can fully log in. Well, that's kind of only sort of true, especially on that very first sprint increment, right? Or, hey, we have this app where, you know, we're going to expand out and add a whole blogging engine to our app. Oh, okay. Well, until the photos are uploaded, you can't really upload blogs because they would have a photo on them. Well, right. Yeah. Okay. Right. Not quite.
I think those are problems that, you know, more immature teams run into, or, you know, smaller teams in particular, right? Where it's like, oh, well, you know, no one knows really how to move forward. And I think that's a difference between, you know, being able to even just work on a project, right? A lot of that comes down to team size and, you know, how many people are you working with, right? You know, and ultimately managing an entire project.
And I think that's interesting you talk about the number of people there, because I think that's where, you know, lots of different agile frameworks have different meanings to the same words, right? So I won't go down that rabbit hole. But, you know, in the framework we use, we obviously have iterations. These are our sprints or equivalent. Then we have what's called a program increment, which is a longer period of time. And we go through a fairly significant planning for each increment, right? And part of that is when you've got 30 different teams building a product, right? There is lots of alignment and kind of what we call it a runway. You kind of have to make sure things happen in a certain order in order to not get those bottlenecks, right? So we know, okay, so team 1 and 4, you need to work on this thing in iteration 1, 2, and 3, because 4, 5, and 6, team 7 and 8 are going to be building on top of that. And this is the thing we promise the customer at the end of the increment. Now, we don't generally just release on an increment basis. When things are done, they're done. You know, we actually put a workshop together on iterative development, and we use I don't know if you've seen the image. There's an image of a car being built, and the top one has a big X through it, and the bottom one is like, yeah, it's, but you know, it's about how you deliver business value in small chunks, right? So we use the story of, hey, I'm a customer. I want to be able to get to the grocery store more efficiently and carry my groceries home, right? So the first option, the one with the big crosser, it's like there's an axle. In iteration 2, there's 2 axles. Iteration 3, there's a body. Iteration 4, there's some doors. And iteration 5, the customer can drive to the grocery store, right? Whereas the other one is like iteration 1, there's a skateboard. I mean, you can get to the grocery store quicker. I mean, your risk reward calculation may say, I'm not going to do that, right? But then iteration 2, now it's a scooter. It's got a handle. Okay, that's a little safer, but I can still only carry what I can carry in my bag, right? Iteration 3, it's a motorcycle or a bicycle. It's got some panniers. You know, you can carry some more groceries. And eventually, you know, you get to the final product. It's a car, right? And, you know, it takes a little longer. There's a bit of rework in that, but the customer's getting happier and happier from iteration 1. Whereas on the first example, the customer's like, didn't see anything to iteration 5. And that just gets them grumbly. It also means you've put 5 iterations worth of work in, and it may turn around you didn't quite give the customer what they wanted. So being able to get that live feedback iteration by iteration, one of the things I call out in this particular image is the first the first one, there's a roof on the car and all that kind of stuff. The second one's convertible. And I was like, you know, maybe they identified over time. They're like, well, it doesn't rain in Southern California, right? We actually don't need the roof on our car. So why did you build it? Right. And again, that's the kind of problem with spending iteration after iteration working on things without actually getting customer feedback. You have that big feedback loop, and that leads to, oh, we created something you didn't actually want because we only talked to you 2 months ago, right? As opposed to every 2 weeks.
And I think the other big thing here, to steal your analogy a little bit too, is it, you know, building that iterative kind of approach, because that's where I would identify that you're building iteratively. It's slowly improving, right? And again, words are mean things to different things to different people, but it also, I think, is a big call out too, and this is why, you know, people look towards that agile process versus that waterfall. Is take your customer and, you know, you get to about that car and they go, well, where am I going to put the dirt? Oh, okay. Well, we actually need to make a pickup, right? And you can kind of make those kind of modifications and changes like that. Or, you know, another business partner of ours, they say, oh, make me a garbage can, right? And then they slowly and iteratively improve. Well, okay, it needs to handle biohazards. And, oh, okay, it's, you know, and eventually you build like a sharps container essentially. And so I think that that's realistically the biggest focus around kind of those two different approaches is customer happiness for sure. And not just am I releasing some product for the public right out of the gate, but can I show the people who are giving me a paycheck or potentially investing in my app, can I show them kind of, hey, we have continued to improve this, instead of, hey, here's one feature of that, like you said, here's the axle. Well, the axle doesn't do me any good. Oh, okay. Well, we put a second axle on. Okay. Still not doing me any good. So, and again, I think that that's the biggest part comes to business investment. I want to see that if I had to pull funds right now, at least I have something that gets me close to what I need.
I think one of the hardest things here is customer buy-in, right? Or whoever this product owner is, you know, it's the buy-in from, you know, the person who's ultimately cutting the checks, right? Is do they understand that when I show you a skateboard, that, hey, this is the iterative approach. We want to work together. We want to make sure that you're getting what you want, right? And I think that this is getting easier as, you know, kind of the industry as a whole is everyone is kind of adopted to kind of the more agile methodologies, right? But, you know, I had a customer just a couple of years ago that, you know, was like, no, we want to give you like $80,000. Go away. Tell us how much time it's going to take and just tell us when you're done, right? And it was a training session, several of them, to get buy-in from them to say, okay, well, we need someone from your team to constantly be looking at this. You know, every 2 weeks we'll have a conversation. We'll, you know, walk you through the things that are working. And, you know, ultimately it was a lot of education just to get them to understand this is what we're trying to build this together, right? We want to make sure that you're happy with the end product and, you know, not take that waterfall approach where, you know, you walk away and 2 years later you come back with something that they don't want, right? Like, and there's plenty of comics and funny things on the internet about that process, but, you know, just that education for the customer is something that, you know, alone, like, I could be furious if you show me a skateboard and I want a car, right? And so a lot of that comes down to customer education.
Well, and right, if you know on day one you need a car, then that's part of your requirements, right? You've identified it, but that's not usually what the mission is. The mission is I need to achieve something. What are you going to do with a car? That's the, you talk about breaking it down into what we call a jobs to be done. The car is not a job to be done. Doing something with the car is the job to be done. And you could equally do that on a different type of transport, you know, a bus, a train, whatever. It's like, you know, there's a happy place where, but different customers have slightly different happy places. I wanted a convertible. I wanted a motorcycle. I wanted a train. Okay. There's a bit of infrastructure goes around with that. But no, I think it's interesting. You mentioned how a lot of the industry is kind of normalized on this. I'm gonna counter that point and say a lot of the industry has committed to doing agile. Not necessarily as many have understood how to be agile. And this is a term we use at work when we're trying to differentiate. We have plenty of teams that, you know, they have the same iterations as we do. They go through the same ceremonies as we do. And, well, I'm going to work on architecture diagrams this iteration. I'm going to work on some paperwork next iteration. I'm going to start coding on iteration 4. And, okay, in iteration 8, hey, I've got something for you. And it's like, that's not iterative. That hasn't delivered value at any point in the process. Why didn't you why didn't you architect the one capability you wanted to build and document the one capability you wanted to build and get, you know, go and then deliver that in one iteration. Now you work on another capability in iteration two, iteration three. Now you've got, you know, your feature, your capability, you know, your broad set of capabilities. And that's, it's a learning process. I mean, it's a big change from how we used to work, how, and in a lot of orgs, especially orgs like mine, even things like budgets still don't work in that way. I mean, the budgets are big. Hey, this is your annual budget for this product or for this project, as it still is in a lot of cases. It's like, well, if it's a project, then we treat it slightly differently than, you know, products have different life cycle kind of considerations, a bit more long-term buy-in, whereas a project's like, okay, we're done, all the resources have been pulled off it, there's no more budget for it, so how do you maintain that, how do you fix bugs, how do you take new feature requests and add to it, or is that just a new project now for, you know what I mean? It's a lots of moving parts.
And I think the other thing that sometimes brings us to problems, right, is we oftentimes think of like, oh, what are traditional models that have worked? And even Agile and kind of the Scrum process, some of it started around manufacturing. And manufacturing is very much, this piece is done, now I attach this next piece, and now I attach this next piece. So we have kind of this just-in-time manufacturing concept that we've been built on. And even as like the human race, right, we went through kind of a big time where factory design was that way. And now we almost don't, because we have everything's going all at once. And so kind of adapting our business workflows to not necessarily match this manufactured process of I built this part, it's done. Now I build this part, it's done. Now I build this part, it's done. And kind of changing that is a process for us.
Yeah, I feel that 2020 informed us of the risks of such a model, though. I think there's still CPU shortages in the car manufacturing space right now. You walk into a forecourt, you're like, where's all the cars? It's like, and they're like, oh, when we get them, we sell them already. They're just not coming in like they used to. And that's one of the challenges. It's a balance, right, between having enough backlog, right, versus, you know, that true just-in-time model where everything is as you need it, and it's built around that concept. And then, you know, one thing goes wrong, one supplier is not supplying, you know, equipment, or another supplier. Most manufacturers have multiples, right? But it's like, I can't get this type of thing anymore.
Randomly, a boat gets stuck in a major
canal somewhere.
I don't know what you're talking about. Yeah. That was full of T-shirts. It's fine.
All right. Well, that's going to wrap me up for Word of the Day.
Nice. So I wanted to talk about, and I'm sure you guys have seen it, there's been a lot of buzz around it, but GitHub and Microsoft, right, just introduced the new Copilot, VS Code extension, Visual Studio extension. Basically, what it is a coding plugin that allows you to type in comments first. And I think there's something like 15 different languages already supported here. So you got C#, you got JavaScript, you know, your editor is smart enough to kind of know what that is. And so you comment out what you want a particular method or function to do. And then what this GitHub Copilot is going to do is it scours public repositories, right? It scours all of these different functions out there that, quote unquote, do what you want it to do. And then it gives you right in your editor a tab complete or a snippet completion of such a function, right? And so like one of the demos here is GitHub Copilot. You know, the demo is typing out, I want to be able to handle an image being uploaded to a particular, I think it's like AWS or something of that nature, right? So it's handle image upload with AWS storage S3 bucket, right? That's the comment. And when you hit tab, you get a code snippet from some random repository out there, who knows where, right? And there's already been some like, hey, is this private code or not? Like, is it actually public? But you get tab complete directly there in your editor. And a lot of people are saying, hey, this is the next big thing. Ever since like IntelliSense, like this is IntelliSense on steroids, right? This is GitHub Copilot. And their little slogan or motto is don't fly solo, right? Don't code solo. You know, code with the collective knowledge of the internet, which is cool for sure, right? But I think there's some potential cautions and, you know, dangerous things that can come with that. You know, and we've all seen these jokes on the internet, but pretty much the developer's keyboard, right, is a control C, you know, control V Stack Overflow button. I think we're going to see that exact same thing.
Did you order one of those on April 1st?
Oh, I mean, I've had one of them for years, right? But no, it's... I almost wonder if we're going to see really bad code being auto-completed from, you know, Copilot trying to be checked in as you know, your own code, right? And from an education standpoint, an education platform, where, you know, we have to deal with things like plagiarism and, you know, making sure that students actually understand the code that they're writing and kind of the reason that you handle things in a particular process, right? There's that little bit of me that has that hesitation with every new piece of software, right? Or with every new advance in the world of development, there's that every layer of abstraction adds another layer of confusion, right? And I almost am fearful of the day that, you know, students all join this program and now they start tab completing these functions that they don't have any idea how they work, right? But from a more seasoned developer, that's going to save me a ton of time. I'm going to actually comment my code. I'm going to document what I want to document, right? And then when I hit tab complete, that's the equivalent of me going to Google and saying, like, well, how do I do the stupid thing again, right? And now I have directly in my editor a snippet that's like, oh, okay, I know with a little bit of maturity, here's the things I need to modify, here's where I need to make my changes, here's where I need to put in my own, you know, little additions, you know, remove that line of code. That's not what we want to do in this particular case. But I don't think it solves the problem of, you know, hey, code is just drag and drop, because I don't think we're anywhere close to that. But it's kind of a neat little thing. I don't know, have you guys seen any of the articles or, you know, little marketing behind this GitHub Copilot?
One of the marketing that got me, and I agree, I am very, very trepidatious about stuff like that, because it makes people feel like, oh my gosh, I'm such a good developer. Look, I just got all this stuff coded up, but they couldn't explain it all. And if it breaks, like, then what? So again, there's that you need to do it the hard way. And we teach very much this philosophy, do it the hard way before you can use like the cool, speed it up, make everything like magic tooling. But one of the parts, I'll be honest, the marketing that got me is the thing I hate doing. And it's kind of like, man, I wish I could just generate this, is like writing tests, right? Being able to, then that's one they specifically even call out, like, hey, here's just some quick, just write the goal of your test and we'll go find some code that basically is that exact test. That's alluring because I'm lazy. And quite frankly, and that's what a lot of this kind of tooling comes from, is kind of almost that laziness of, oh, I don't want to write this. Oh, here, boop, done. But again, I think that you have to be so careful with stuff like this, because the AI is good and great and all that kind of stuff, but it could be easily corrupted or trained wrong, or, you know, how people ran into that with the YouTube algorithms, and that's where we had the whole Elsa gate or whatever, where people were, people taught the YouTube algorithm that if you like this video, then you'll like this other video. And this is a different boat, but I could see equal vulnerabilities.
Yeah, I think that's, you know, when we start talking about AI, we talk about machine learning, you know, we talk about these different concepts, all of it comes down to how well the model is trained, of course, right? With GitHub being the primary backer of this Copilot, right, you know, I have hopes that they're putting a lot of, you know, a lot of thought behind what are they actually using to train the model, right? And for right now, from what I've seen, I'm skeptical that it's actually AI, right? I lean more heavily on its, you know, text comparison. It's looking at actual code in repositories. It's using, GitHub's done a very good job in recent years, especially saying, hey, we know what this method does. You can even, jump around in GitHub, you know, control clicking on different methods, and you can see where they're referenced and things of that nature. So we have good language models behind, you know, our primary languages, JavaScript, C#, Java, all of these. And so when people do a good job of documenting that function, you know, then it's easy for these different models to be trained and to make sure that they're being trained correctly. But how often do you guys come across code, especially, you know, written for a code review, that it's like, hey, here's this one function that does this one thing, but in reality, it's got these like four extra lines of code in it that are calling out to these external services that are pretty unique or doing this extra job that really doesn't belong inside of that function, right? You're gonna still get all of that garbage, right? We see all of that garbage on Stack Overflow. I can't tell you the number of times I've had, you know, students or junior developers copy and paste code from Stack Overflow, submit it for code review, and it's like, what does XYZ, you know, compute do?
Why are you sending all your cookies to this one web server?
Right, exactly, right? What are you doing with that? And so, again, it doesn't eliminate the need to be a good developer, right? And if anything, I think it's going to potentially reduce the development time but increase the review time, right? And so everywhere there's trade-offs, right? But I'm excited about it. I think it's a pretty cool thing. Right now, it's a request to join the beta. Once you get accepted into the beta program, then you can go download the extension and log in and tie it all in together. So I'm on the wait list. I haven't been able to actually test it out personally yet. Still kind of waiting for that good old acceptance. So hopefully future updates on that to come for sure. But
if only I knew a person at GitHub.
I know, right? Insider connection, maybe.
I think it's interesting what you guys said. Obviously, you have a unique position, as educators who are trying to teach people to develop. Things like this are like, whoa. I remember the same thing being an issue with Wikipedia, like back in the, you can't cite Wikipedia as a source because it's not trustworthy. I'm like, it's more accurate than the Encyclopedia Britannica. What's your point? Right? But teachers all over were like, no, it's too easy. You can't do it. And I'm like, but this is the world your students are graduating into. Why are you holding them? It's you know what I mean? That there's this interesting kind of point in time where that tipping point occurs. And it's like, how many of your students that graduate understand things like bounds checking and garbage collection? You don't generally need to do these things in higher level languages these days. But if you were writing C, then you would. Most of us don't write C anymore unless there's a really good reason to, right? We have Rust. So it's interesting. Are we going to see more tooling around this, more maturity? What exactly is this AI that GitHub have doing, or is it really just looking for like-minded pieces of code and then just copying them? Because now we've got licensing concerns, and I've seen a lot of conversations going, are we just reading public repos? What licenses are we looking at? Are we going to see licenses change to say, no, you can't use this for training an AI model? Or is the AI actually learning and then regurgitating something from scratch, right? And that's the interesting thing. I don't know.
That's actually something that sometimes there's only so many ways to skin a cat, right? Like that saying goes. But, to say that the AI model is generating it all from scratch, is that even possible, right? If it was trained on a particular model, it's looking at, hey, this is done in this particular way, right? Copying and pasting one character at a time just by rewriting what is already written is still, is that scratch, right? that's hard to say.
I think you look at, it's definitely the difference between AI and machine learning, right? And this is drifting into Ryan's topic a little bit, but I think the biggest thing for me is it text comparing and saying, hey, here's 30 different times someone has done basically this job. Or different people have done this job, and here's what's the same in their code, and here's what's different in their code, and can I find those consistencies, and is it just variable namings and stuff like that? But I think that there's just so much of it that, again, it's a powerful tool for people who know what they're doing, and it's an incredibly dangerous tool for people who don't, right? And I think pilot is just such a funny term because, if I were to go down to the airport, could I fly a small little Cessna? Maybe. Could I fly a jumbo jet? No. So I think that's kind of where it's, you're trusting that autopilot. And like you said, it is building and developing that trust of it. There's just so much there that who says this is good code?
Right. And I think a lot of that, again, it comes down to the model, right? But don't get confused. It's not pilot, it's co-pilot. You still are in charge as the developer, right? You have to be.
Which I think identifies a little bit better naming, but still it's you have to be able to fly this plane 100% by yourself, and now you have an assistant.
Yeah, and I think that's great, right? And I can imagine, getting some git diff comparisons instantly in line with, the code that you're already doing, or, if you're writing something in a particular way, and this is, I don't think is any different if you're used to the resharper tool in C# Visual Studio, right? I write an if statement and resharper immediately inverts it for me, right? And it's like, oh, this is cleaner. Oh yeah, that's actually easier to read. Oh yeah, thanks. Those tools already exist and they do an excellent job. I love them, right? And I can imagine this GitHub Copilot being something very similar, but it's interesting to the concept behind how it's supposed to work. And if you read the marketing and the, you know, they're leaning real heavy on the, this is AI, this is, you know, it's the computer looking at these different models. It's looking at all these different repositories, and it's going to tell you what is clean code. Like, I don't know, can it?
I mean, I think, again, I'm not too familiar with what the roadmap is, but I see some interesting kind of use cases where, oh, is Copilot is installed in my editor, my choice. It's watching me code every day. Is it going to start preempting? Is it going to start helping me out? Like, oh, I know when you create a new function, you have to create documentation blocks. You have to get, you know, you do this. I'm also going to go and throw a test in for you because you just made new capability. Is Copilot going to start tailoring itself to me? Or is it really just I'm going to help you fill in stuff from stuff I found on Stack Overflow for you? Because, right? I mean, it's nice. I don't have to context switch back to my browser.
So one of the things I see, it does use OpenAI, which is OpenAI stuff. Some of the stuff people have done with OpenAI is just bonkers, but it's super cool. Like, have you ever seen like the this cat does not exist or this person does not exist or any of that kind of stuff? That's the same kind of engine that does it. And so I think it's definitely one of those, like, and I haven't read all their kind of documents and replies to it and things like that, of being able to, again, give it that feedback of, no, this is not a good statement, or no, this does not meet requirements. Because I definitely know those other ones are built around that idea of, you can say, hey, this one fails that test, and you're further training that machine language. But that kind of dives into kind of that whole other section of AI and ML.
Yeah, and which is, you know, I think what Ryan wanted to deep dive on today as well. So I think we could roll like straight into that concept, you know, of the deep dive of AI, right? The Copilot in particular, though, they have some configuration that you can do. I believe it's through like a YAML file or something of that nature, and you can set up like your specific editor requirements. Whether you're going to be able to train the model specifically to yourself, that I don't know yet, but that actually to me seems a lot more interesting. Like, if I could say for our org in particular, here's some of our, you know, not necessarily just code styling, code preferences, but, you know, that predictive model of, okay, well, here's what needs to come next, right? If you generate a service, here's your XYZ controller. And a lot of those tools already exist, you know, but if it could autocomplete a lot of the other stuff for you, then that's great, right? That it's going to save a ton of time.
Yeah, well, we've talked about this in other contexts as well, but kind of that idea of being a code ninja and stuff like that and blending in, how much will it generate code in, kind of like Ryan was saying, in the flavor in which I write that code, right? When I do this, I typically do that. And when I do this, I do that. And or is it going to be obviously like, oh, here's a really complex method that doesn't really, it's not readable and it doesn't flow with kind of how your normal coding conventions are. Oh, this one has a for of loop, and you almost never use a for of loop anywhere else in any of your code. So why is it here? Oh, okay, well, I generated that code. At the same time, though, sometimes that could be a great opportunity for you to learn a little bit, something maybe you didn't even know.
Yeah, I would say for sure. Like, I'm going to push again on ReSharper, right? I feel like ReSharper alone, just using it on a daily basis, made me a much better developer, made me be able to think about, you know, I would write things in a more, you know, traditional junior approach, and ReSharper would say, hey, there's a lot easier way. Let's clean this up. Let's reduce this function that you just wrote that was 40 lines of code, and we're able to reduce it down to, you know, 28. And it was like, holy crap, like, that's amazing, right? And so I'm looking at this with a lot of hope and with a lot of, you know, excitement that it's going to be great. Again, beta, it's probably going to take 1 to 2 years before it really takes off.
Oh, wow. Wow.
Wow.
So with that, you know, I'll segue or let Ryan segue kind of more into the OpenAI machine learning concepts anyways, but...
Yeah, so I think I you know, and by no means am I an expert in this field specifically. It's not my forte. But I, you know, I did want to kind of carry on the conversation a little about Copilot, because obviously there's a lot of things that have come up around, you know, the ethics of it, you know, what it can actually do, what it can't do, you know, what its limitations are, you know, and whether or not it's actually going to output quality software for us or not. You know, if its model is all of the stuff in GitHub, well, I hope it's not looking at my repos, because they're not very good.
Yeah, the code right. In the code vault, this is kind of a way back topic, but the code vault, please don't ever open that code vault.
Yeah, I got that badge, and I was like, oops, so what did you put of mine in Antarctica? No, so, you know, obviously... you know, I'm a, you know me, I'm a bit of a pedant when it comes to like buzzwords and terms. Obviously, our AI is very broad buzzword these days. It's used very frivolously for different things. You know, so let's talk about it. You know, from the context of AI, machine learning, deep learning, that kind of stuff. So we're not obviously talking about, you know, the singularity and artificial general intelligence. Like that's not what we're talking about. We're really talking about, you know, specialist models that can be trained and reinforced and ultimately make decisions on their behalf based on that information that they've been kind of learning, right? So so these are the three terms we see a lot: deep learning, machine learning, and artificial intelligence, and they all kind of build upon one another. So ultimately, deep learning at our bottom tier is kind of it's really a processing system, right? So data goes in, and then it hits these kind of hidden layers, you know, much like if you look at what a deep learning model looks like, it's, you know, it's like a ton of different neurons all connected to different things, and, you know, things filter through the system and understanding comes out at the output layer, right? And so the more times things go in, the more things are reinforced, the more things understand, right? And those kind of that kind of data processing model is, I think data itself is something that we use fairly broadly in industry. Data, what does data mean? Like, what is that to me? We've been recently talking about the wisdom hierarchy at work and how, you know, data, as it's more understood and more structured, it becomes more valuable. So data at the bottom layer is just data points, a timestamp, and all like that. Right? You start throwing that through models like this and through systems like this, and now all of a sudden you start gaining information and knowledge and wisdom out of the other end because you've gone through, you know, you've tied a bunch of things together.
And this is, and to me, my understanding, and a little bit to put it maybe in an example of that is, I know that you can find certain websites that'll say, hey, read all of the reviews for this product. Is the sentiment usually positive or negative? And really all that's doing is filtering words within sentences, trying to gain context based on those words. And in the end, just output, here's a positivity rating. It's just analyzing a bunch of stuff without really knowledge of what one thing is deeply of this is that, but understanding the relationship between two objects, therefore, means this.
Right. And in machine learning, you have that kind of what they call the supervised mode. And that's when everything is labeled and you go through it and you kind of prune it yourself and you kind of give the system input based on its initial kind of situation. Like, oh, okay, what you've seen here isn't a cat. Okay, so you discard that. And that's how obviously that training process starts and obviously moves into reinforcement mode where it starts being able to make those decisions itself. And then you get the unsupervised learning, no data, no anything. Now my model can work for me. I can just throw stuff at it and I will trust that I'm getting fairly accurate response back. How well you've trained it is pretty going to base on what kind of outliers you get and how accurate your output is. But, you know, again, that goes back to that reinforcing stage. Are you continually training your thing? We as humans, we learn all the time. You know, we've got six senses that are always kind of operating and always kind of feeding, you know, feeding back in, giving us new context. You know, we can walk in a room and instantly tell you there's four chairs here, a TV, six tables, et cetera, right? You know, an AI system can't. It has to literally kind of look at every pixel and go, what is this, right? It doesn't have that kind of instantaneous. I go back to your JPEG example. Like when we're looking in a room, we get that kind of blurry JPEG. We've just looked at it and already we can tell what shapes are. That's a triangle. That's a square. That's, you know, and give it another second. Now it's a chair. Now it's a TV, right? It's a little different for an AI model. Obviously, it doesn't work quite that way. But how well you train that system is going to, you know, define what kind of accuracy you get out of it, how much you trust it. And it's all just algorithms and stuff. At the end of the day, it's just computer code, right? It's not, and again, that's why it's not actual AI, right? This is not artificial general intelligence that's as smart as we are. Maybe smarter than me by now, I don't know, but you know. Yeah. It's a very exciting space. Like I said, it's not one I'm super into, but you know, it doesn't come up a lot in my field at the moment. However, I see so many use cases for, you know, for these kind of systems. But it really comes down to, do we actually have the data already, and are we just sitting on it and not doing anything with it because we can't process it well enough? You know, we don't have the expertise to kind of go through it. You know, part of getting data from that level up to information and knowledge and wisdom, you start getting into the realms of data engineers, data scientists, you know, statisticians, you know, people that can actually look at all these things and discern patterns. And obviously they're few and far between. You know, whereas if I can get, you know, an algorithm written once, or I can get some system written once, and then I can start feeding stuff into a computer system to do this, can I now make that jump from raw data to knowledge and wisdom without a data architect, or maybe one across multiple systems rather than, you know, five per team, that kind of model. You know, I think there's a lot of exciting use cases for these kind of things. You know, GitHub Copilot, obviously one such example. I think we've all seen the cool deep fake imaging systems. You know, my friends at the moment, they've got that face app thing on their phone and they're like, look, I can turn myself into this other person. And I'm like, that's creepy. And you're also training the deep fake network of the future, right? But, you know, this is what people do. This is what people are having fun doing it right now. And it's like, I think, you know, I've seen some of those concerning kind of things. You see those videos and it's like, you know, there's a speech that, you know, a president's giving, you know, previous President Reagan or something like that. And you're like, wait, did he actually say that? And it's like, nope, he did not. Right? And you're like, whoa. And we as trusting people, we see something like that and we tie validity to it. And you're like, oh, I trust that person. They've told me something in a video. It must be true. And it's like, well.
Right. And the entire video can be fake these days. And, you know, I think this goes back to, and I think it's been this way forever, but you can use tools for good or evil, right? Regardless. And that's been since the shovel, right?
Can you use a D20 for evil?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes.
And so a lot of it just comes down to the wielder, right? And so that's, you know, in the world of like cybersecurity, a lot of, you know, quote unquote hackers, right? The bad guys, the cyber criminals, they use a lot of the exact same tools that all the, you know, cybersecurity professionals use as well. And so, yeah, you can train a model to be good or you can train a model to be bad. You know, but I have a lot of, again, hope and excitement that, you know, this step towards, you know, AI, like, and again, Hollywood has a version of AI and then we have like what is actual, right? And I think it was... you know,
Skynet's not a thing.
You know, Skynet, I think we're ways off from, you know, Skynet, HAL, things of that nature. But, you know, I think it was some university was actually training pigeons to identify or to help, to help these pigeons identify cancer cells in patients, right? And so they were able to take birds, right, pigeons, and train them through a model system well enough that they came out with something like 96% accurate pigeons could identify, is this cancerous or is this not cancerous, right? And we talk about, you know, you have false positives, false negatives, you know, true positives, true negatives. And so those are kind of the things that you start talking about more with this AI and this machine learning and things of that nature. But if we can train birds to identify, you know, at a 96% accuracy, why can't we train these computers, right? We've all know that, you know, computers, they can process data so much faster than we can as humans, you know, regardless of the you know, computers blew us away in chess how many years ago. I think computers now have also beat, you know, the Go Masters and, you know, all of these games that, you know, we said for years, a computer will never be able to do that. We've been proven wrong over and over and over again, right? And as these predictive models get better and better and we are responsibly training them, you know, I see them being good things for us for the future for sure. And I don't have necessarily the fear of the, you know, the Skynet concepts. I don't think the robots are turning evil on us. I think people turn evil on us and people will use these systems for their own personal gain.
I think that's where we start to run into other economic problems, right? And it's less about the technology and more about the culture of our world, right? This is actually somewhat in your backyard, Ryan. In London, there's a warehouse that does groceries, and it's known as like the Hive because it's essentially, it's a bunch of dumb robots powered by a much more powerful robot to basically handle a massive, there's 2,300 bots. And they pick products, and basically it's for grocery stores, and they have over 58,000 products, and these robots just race around at the top of like this giant grid, and the robots are basically controlled by one master, and that's why they call it the Hive. These are essentially the worker bees, and then there's the hive mind that basically says, okay, go here, go there, and it keeps it, the warehouse, highly efficient by making sure none of these robots run into each other. And while that's not necessarily true AI, it does become kind of that deep learning where it essentially says, okay, cool. Well, here's the top products. I'm actually going to reschedule that these products get moved. And when they get loaded next time, put them in cell 64A instead of 64, you know, 100 because, you know, there's more room in that stack and there's less room to travel. And now it's now figuring out what's the shortest path and pathfinding and all that kind of stuff gets involved. And you kind of have to ask yourself, too, is it, you know, the robots that are actually picking up the groceries are fairly dumb. They go to the cell they're told to, follow the path they're told to, pick up the product, whatever it is, and deliver it to bin 7, right? So those parts are fairly dumb. And now there's this master computer over that. Well, how many levels of computer is that, right? How many layers are you now looking at? Is it just one robot with a bunch of more or less cells or neurons, right? Are the, and actually kind of stealing this a little bit from Tom Scott, but if you think about this, the cells in your gut biome that break down food, is that you? Or is it its own thing, right? And so that's where we start to get into that weird layer of, and you kind of joke about Skynet, but are the robots, the Terminators, are they their own robot? Or are they just the fingernails of some master system?
Conscious thought versus unconscious thought, right? And I would say all computers at this point in time, you know, all of our AI models, machine learning, regardless of how good you think they are, you know, I don't think any of them are capable of conscious thought, right? You know, and I think we're a long, 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 I don't know how many times I could say long, ways off from, you know, having a computer with conscious thought. We can mimic consciousness, but I don't think we'll actually achieve that anytime soon.
I don't think Kurzweil will agree with you. I'm pretty sure he predicted 2050 for the singularity. So
2050.
Somewhere around that. I mean, you got to understand the logarithmic curve of things like computers, right? Like Moore's Law by itself is like, you know, every 18 months, the number of what transistors on a chip doubles. Now, yeah, okay, that's slowed down a little bit, but now we just do it with cores. So, you know, I think 5 years ago, I was watching Intel and IBM demo chips with 50, 100 cores on them. And it's like, you know, if they're specially architected for a certain type of thing, you look at a modern graphics card for machine learning, right? You have this little powerhouse in the back of your office, and it's like, I mean, it's more computing processing power than NASA had for the entire Apollo kind of program, not just one launch, but the entire program. And it's sitting in a corner in your room using, you know,
Minecraft.
Yeah, maybe in your career. Mine's probably sitting there turned off because I was busy. But it's like, you know, it's interesting, Mark, you talked about the kind of, you know, the social kind of aspect of it. I think one of the things we don't talk enough about, I think a lot of people do, but, you know, when it comes to these models and these trainings, you know, there's very much a bias implied based on who did the training. And it's like, you know, I am an individual and I have bias, unconscious and not. So when I'm training a system and other people like me are training a system, this bias is being reinforced whether I'm doing it consciously or not. How does this system, what does this system now do? Is it in control of things? You think about, you know, some of the recent kind of conversations about Amazon having, you know, things that automatically look at your resume and hire you and fire you based on these things. Like no person actually gets to look at it at this point. It's like, is that, you know, who trained that model? Like, are you automatically like discounting resumes because they have a word in you didn't like or that you traditionally shied away from? Is that a fair system or is it just the nature of needing to scale and operate at the levels we do these days, right?
Yeah, I think, you know, that's exactly what I was talking about. Like, using tools for good or evil, right? And, you know, at what point are we going to see, you know, racism and things of that nature being trained into these different models, right?
Well, and I would argue, again, that's not necessarily inherently I did that intentionally.
Right? Like, yeah, right, not maliciously. There's this right, unconscious bias there.
The Microsoft right? team, when Kinect first came out, had a difficult time. The Kinect had a difficult time recognizing people who were African-American because no one on the Kinect team was. And so they'd never tested it against someone, a person of color. And so suddenly this launches and now it has this problem, recognized facial recognition. And so, and they were like, oh yeah, that's great. Oh, wait, we never tested this because we didn't know. We just didn't recognize we had a bias that we had never done this because it worked on all of us.
Yeah. Conscious, again, conscious bias, unconscious bias, right? Conscious thought, unconscious thought. So yeah, a lot of it comes down to the effective training of the model. And, you know, we're all at fault as humans, right? You know, we're training something. And I think that's where, you know, we have a responsibility to potentially look at cross-training of these models, right? Cross-training, it's almost like peer-reviewed, right? Peer-reviewed articles You know, science papers, things of that nature. We've had peer review standards for a very long time. When are we going to start saying, okay, we need two bots, or we need two AIs to be, you know, cross-trained against each other, you know, to validate if, you know, this is an accurate model, and who's to say what's accurate.
And I think developers are all familiar with the concept of bugs, right? If something is surfaced in a model, oh, that's a bug. I can send it down a different reinforcement path. I can say, okay, now you need to look at a bunch of different data. You need to learn that this is also normal, right? This is, you know, you just apparently didn't look at much of it before. I think, and that's a challenge, you know. And I've seen a lot of the big companies actually form nice, you know, ethical bodies on stuff like this. And again, I don't know what that turns into, if it's just for show. You know, we've all seen that before as well. And it's like, you know, what is the future, and how do we do it right? And again, I think that's one of the reasons I haven't put my toe too far in the AI ML world just yet. I think, you know, it's very exciting, and there's a lot of cool stuff. Obviously, we haven't gone as deep as we'd normal on a deep dive here. I kind of wanted to just carry on from the Copilot conversation and all the things we've been talking about around Copilot the last 2 weeks. So yeah, maybe we'll do a more deep ML one. More time when we've
or even just I feel like we talked, you know, there's the different layers, right? Machine learning, what is all that, what is the ethics of it all? I think there's quite a bit there to talk about, but just from a time sake, we have run a little bit long on this episode, so I'll appreciate everyone who sat and listened through it with us, and with that, we'll go ahead and wrap up this episode of The Dev Team.
That's a wrap for The Dev Team. If you enjoyed it, please be sure to subscribe to our channel for the latest content anywhere great podcasts are found. And remember, if you want Kincode,
wash your hands.